Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The exodus of approximately 6 million black people from the American South between 1915 and 1970 had a significant role in setting the stage of the civil rights movements of the early 1960s. Many of the children of those who left the South participated in desegregation efforts, which included the Freedom Rides and lunch counter sit-ins. The Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965, which attempted to resolve employment discrimination and define voting rights, only changed the law. Many young blacks, however, did not see changes in their everyday life. The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was born out of this disillusionment. Although infiltrated and feared by the FBI, the Black Panther Party pioneered social and community programs, including free medical clinics, free meals, and educational programs. Our guest in this edition of Radio Curious is Columbia University Sociology and Gender Studies Professor Alondra Nelson, author of Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. Alondra Nelson and I visited by phone from her office in New York City on February 13, 2012, and began our conversation when I asked her to describe the Black Panther Party.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which was its original name, was, a radical left. They identified as Marxist-Leninist organization, but they were also the children of migrants. They were the children of parents who were refugees from Jim Crow. And so one of the important things I think we should understand about the Black Panther Party is that they emerge in reaction to the dissatisfaction that people still felt, despite the fact that we had had these great social strides with the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 65. The Black Panther Party emerges in October 1966. In the face of the reality that so much has changed, but so much remained to be changed, particularly for poor communities and poor communities of color. So you have that on the one hand. I think it's also important to thinking of them as the children of immigrants, as the children of migrants, rather, like immigrants from all over who have been so central to the founding of American society and the proliferation of American society. They are the children of people who came seeking a new and better life for their children. And so there's a dual disappointment here. There's a disappointment that changing race policies with regard to laws, racial laws in the United States, are not leading to always substantive changes in the experiences of people like Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who would co-found the Black Panther Party. But also that there was they had a sense of disaffection because the new and better life that their parents had hoped for them also wasn't coming to fruition.
Before we go too much farther, can you describe in brief detail the Great Migration, who migrated, and the circumstances?
Sure. So the Great Migration happened pretty much in two waves, one in the early 20th century, about 1910, 1915, and then there was a second wave around World War II. But there were people, of course, coming in between those periods. But it was, over the course of, say, 20 or 30 years, you had millions and millions of African Americans moving from the South to the Midwest, in places in the West like Los Angeles and Oakland. And this is a significant demographic shift because your listeners who know about the history of slavery and the demography of the plantation South, there were pockets in the South where the population part of the sort of paradox of slavery, for example, in the South was that you had communities in which you had 90 or 95% people who were slaves, who were blacks, who were slaves, and you had a distinct minority of whites. And so the South was significantly African American. And so to have millions of people leave changed not only the South, but also the North. And so there were several routes. I mean, there was a route that went often from places like Georgia that went up to the Mid-Atlantic and to the Northeast. So places, people from Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, for example, might end up in Washington, D.C., like my grandparents did, or they might end up in Boston, or they might end up in New Haven, Connecticut. people in the more western southern states like Arkansas and Texas and Louisiana often ended up in, Los Angeles and also Oakland, California.
And can you tell us what the term Black Panthers stands for?
The Black Panther, of course, is a large cat in the wild, but it also has deeply symbolic political meaning. So it was the name of the political party during the Southern, we might call the Southern Civil Rights Struggle. There was a Lowndes County Freedom Party in Lowndes County, Georgia, that was trying to get voting rights for African Americans in the Jim Crow South. And their emblem for this Lowndes County Freedom Party was a Black Panther that looks very much like the iconic Black Panther that we know of the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party borrowed freely from the Lowndes County Freedom Party, and they, pay tribute to the fact that they borrowed freely from this emblem. And, it was meant to suggest the blackness of black people, but also a sense of, courage and bravery in the face of segregation and Jim Crow.
Alondra, can you describe the medical discrimination that existed in the 50s and 60s that the Black Panther Party was challenging?
Yes. Medical discrimination is a term that I use quite broadly in the book, and it describes several different factors in the way that people had to deal with forms of professional and inequality and health inequality. So, at least legally, up until 1964, we had Jim Crow not only in lunch counters and buses and these sorts of things. We had Jim Crow in medical facilities. So Jim Crow in medical facilities meant in Atlanta, for example, you had the Grady Hospital Tower. So you had two towers, the Grady Hospital Towers, one for black people and one for white people that stood next to each other. You had separate but equal hospital facilities. It also meant that you had often allegedly separate but equal but clearly unequal medical training. So you had black nursing schools and you had white nursing schools. It was also the case that in hospitals where people would be seen, black doctors couldn't get visiting rights in hospitals. So there would be patients that they couldn't see in their hospitals because of their race, even though they were qualified as doctors. So there was a sort of large scale or macro or structural sense of medical discrimination that was about the way that hospitals functioned, the way in which black medical and health professionals could or could not be trained or could or could not have access. It was often the case in the Jim Crow South in particular that they even had, that Jim Crow extended outside of the hospitals to ambulance services, so that, if you called a dispatcher because you were bearing witness to someone having a heart attack or someone had been shot or something had befallen someone and they needed emergency transportation to the hospital, the dispatcher would ask you whether or not the person was black or white because they had black and white ambulances. And then based on whether or not the person was black or white, they could decide indiscriminately whether or not they wanted to send an ambulance to a black community, send a black ambulance to the black community. And then there was discrimination in the very practice of medicine. And this is where I think the Panther story is key. So we understand that, even though there was racial inequality in places like Oakland, that it didn't operate in the same way that it did in the South. So you didn't have black ambulances and white ambulances, particularly by the time you get to 1966 when the party emerges. But it was certainly the case that people didn't necessarily have access to health care, and the care that they had access to was often very poor. So the Black Panther Party spends a lot of time both in their writing and their public pronouncements in parks and at various events talking about the sort of experience of a hypothetical sort of person, a poor black person who would go to a hospital. And it would involve things like waiting for a long time in the waiting room to be seen and perhaps not being seen at all after, taking a whole day off from work to wait, having to have an interaction with a doctor who was disrespectful, who didn't take your pain seriously, who didn't take your ailment seriously, who treated you brusquely. Medical discrimination and the way in which the Panthers were dealing with it moved from the large scale of the hospital and the ways hospitals operated to the small scale of how doctors interacted with poor and black patients.
How did the Black Panther Party deal with that on a material plane? What steps did they take?
Yeah, well, I think materially they dealt with this by setting up their own clinics. That was the response to this. You know, if people can't get care, as the Panthers understood they had a right to, and the care that they, you know, should have access to, we're going to start our own clinics. And so by 1970, the Black Panther Party have a national network of health clinics. The national headquarters of the party, the leadership of the party, requires that all chapters have health clinics. And the clinics were run, they were very local, very community-based, very grassroots organizations. And so they were run with kind of community resources, and each of the chapters were, individual chapters were responsible for getting the clinics up and running. And the clinics did things like, you know, blood pressure screening. Sometimes they gave immunizations. Many of them had, you know, modest pharmacies. The clinics in Berkeley and Chicago actually had pretty well supplied pharmacies. And the clinics also served for the party, I guess, another function. They were a way for people to get access to information about housing or to get support or help if they were dealing with a difficult landlord. It was a way for them to get food, if they needed clothing. So the clinics really took health as a very broad, and the party as health activists had a very broad definition of health. And they understood that all of, you know, that social issues have everything to do with people's health care.
Can you talk about the sickle cell anemia project that the Black Panther Party had in its clinics and its importance to people who may carry that cell?
One of the success stories of the Black Panther Party's health activism is their sickle cell anemia campaign. In 1970, 1971, 72, when the Black Panther Party was involved in sickle cell outreach and testing, very little was known about sickle cell anemia in the public and certainly in Black communities. And part of what the Black Panther Party was engaged in was just raising national awareness about the disease, both for Black communities and that suffer disproportionately from the disease. So it's, you know, politically, the Black Panthers made it and underscored the fact that it was a Black disease. So the Black Panther Party did a lot of public education around the disease that included things like explaining in fine detail the sort of molecular dynamics of the disease in their newspaper. And so the issue that they raised is what we today call racial health disparities. So part of how they rose awareness and were beating the drum around the disease was that they were saying, you know, they exposed the fact that the state was spending lots of money on other genetic diseases that were more likely to affect other communities, and that sickle cell anemia as a disease, by comparison, was neglected. And so it would be quite successful. They would garner in the course of particularly 1972, lots and lots of attention around the disease, such that the Nixon administration, that was, you know, no fan of the Black Panther Party, would increase tenfold in the course of that year the money that the federal government dedicated to the to research into the eradication of sickle cell anemia.
What does sickle cell anemia do to people?
Sickle cell anemia occurs predominantly in people of African descent. The red blood cells are usually round, like, you know, like a donut or like a penny. And sickled cells literally take on the shape of a sickle. So they sort of curve and they're sort of C-shaped or V-shaped. And what that means in the body is that oxygen can't circulate in the bloodstream as well. It often causes pain in the joints, and people are just not getting oxygenated blood circulating through their body. So it affects the organs. It affects, you know, oxygen is the stuff of life. We all need it. When the Panthers were working on sickle cell anemia, it was very much a childhood disease, so that people were dying often before their 20s, often before their teens, if they had the disease, the sickle cell disease, not the marker. Today, people live a lot longer. They can live, you know, until their 40s.
Why is it a disease that is predominant in people with African origins?
The basic reason of any disease, even diseases that are predominant among, say, Ashkenazi Jews, is partly just because of, you know, circumstance and historical factors and et cetera about how people choose to marry. So, I mean, so part of the story of genetic disease is about communities marrying within these small communities over generations again and again and again. And in fact, one of the solutions to genetic diseases, one might say, is for people to sort of intermarry or marry outside of the group that's married traditionally over time. Politically and historically, why it was especially interesting to the Black Panther Party is that in places where there was malaria, so in places, parts of Africa that are malarial belts, the trait for sickle cell anemia is actually a good thing because the trait for sickle cell anemia provides some protection against malaria. But in places like Oakland, that isn't a malarial belt, you know, it loses its genetic advantage or the role that it's supposed to have in natural selection.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Alondra Nelson, a professor of sociology at Columbia University in New York City. She's the author of Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Professor Alondra Nelson, how would you characterize medical discrimination to people of color now in the United States?
Obviously, things have changed quite a good deal with regards to medical discrimination since 1966 or 1972 when the Black Panther Party were doing their work. I mean, I think it's the case that there's been so much more training and awareness around the importance of how doctors interact with patients. And, you know, it wasn't only the Black Panther Party. It was women's health activism, health activists, and also health activists who were working in new left organizations like Health PAC, who made, you know, the medical profession really aware that they had to treat people with respect. And so that's certainly changed. I mean, there was a time, you know, where people didn't feel empowered to ask questions about their doctors.
I want to ask you about the consequences of the FBI looking at the work of the Black Panthers.
The FBI had, you know, everything to do with the decimation of the Black Panther Party as an organization. The FBI had a counterintelligence program that's called COINTELPRO that basically spied on, intervened in radical organizations. And this was well before the Black Panther Party. It goes back to at least the post-World War II period. And so part of what they did was, you know, surveillance and spying. The FBI often sort of sponsored these agent provocateurs who would go into organizations like the Black Panther Party and create paranoia and, you know, sense of sort of skepticism and distrust among the members of the organization. The effect of the FBI was to both sort of literally attack activist organizations from the outside, but also to corrode them from the inside.
And what happened in the Black Panther Party as a result of this FBI intervention?
Well, I think that people turned against each other. I mean, it's, you know, as someone who interviewed many members of the party for my book, it's still the case that sometimes members of the party will say, well, this happened, or we did this, or we were engaged in this kind of work in the clinic, and then there was this man or this woman who were working there, and we're pretty sure this person was an FBI agent. So there's this sort of still ongoing sense that people, that there were FBI agents. And so there were a lot of, so on a material basis, I mean, the intervention of the FBI and state repression, even on the municipal and local level, meant that places like clinics were, the Black Panther clinics were raided constantly. And so part of why the clinics often had difficulty is that indiscriminately, members of the police department or the FBI would come in and destroy equipment, would tear down walls, would confiscate equipment. Elaine Brown told me a story in Los Angeles in which they were getting a delivery of some equipment from a New Left clinic in another part of town. And then the police followed the truck that was coming to deliver the equipment to them and then confiscated and destroyed it. And it was also the case that the FBI and local state authorities acted on the clinics by sort of tying them up in red tape. So they would try to get them to go to court or have to get licenses and these sorts of things. But the overall effect is that with regard to the Panther activism more generally and health activism in particular is that, you know, we don't have a sense of all of the work that the Panthers were doing. And so part of, you know, people often ask me, why don't we know about the health activism? And part of the reason we don't know is that the FBI's counterintelligence program was so effective in shaping our narrative about the party, not only on people on the right who are critical of the party, but even amongst people on the left who are supportive of the party, such that we have a very, very narrow and very thin sort of narrative of what the party did.
What was the threat that was perceived by the FBI?
Well, I think that the threat was that the party would, in doing these these great social welfare programs would increasingly garner support from local communities and that the movement would grow. And notoriously, J. Edgar Hoover, you know, described the Black Panther Party's breakfast programs, one of its social programs, like the health clinics, as being one of the greatest threats to an American national security. And so there was a sense that the Black Panther Party's social welfare programs, equal to or more so than them carrying bandoliers or carrying guns or defending their communities against police brutality, was the thing that the state was concerned about.
So that comes down to self-determination and self-defense.
Absolutely, yes.
What more needs to be done to alleviate discrimination?
Well, I think part of what needs to be done is that that we need to remember the stories of the Panthers and other people, other activists working during this health activism. So to the extent that the counterintelligence program COINTELPRO is successful in squashing or muting these stories about people's empowerment around healthcare issues and their agency, we need to restore that historical narrative and let people know these stories once again. I think it's also the case that we need better training for doctors still. I mean, there are, over the last sort of 10 to 15 years, there's been an outgrowth of what are called cultural competency programs. So this part of the training for physicians and nurses, which is about getting people to, doctors in particular, who often come from elite backgrounds, regardless of doctors' racial and ethnic backgrounds, they often come from elite backgrounds. And so, there's been efforts through these cultural competency programs to get doctors to have more empathy and to really understand what it must be like to, for example, not have health insurance and to have to rely on emergency rooms, or to have health insurance but to not be treated well, or not to have insurance that's sufficient for the needs that you or one of your loved ones are suffering, and these sorts of things. So I think there are still things that can happen within the healthcare sector. And, frankly and honestly, I think that we need a universal healthcare program so all people have access to healthcare.
What happened to the Black Panthers clinics?
Most of the clinics went away over time. I mean, a few of them barely got off the ground, and some were more successful. There are no currently existing Black Panther clinics, but there are clinics with deep, deep ties to the Panther legacy that give us an example of how this work has continued. One example is the Carolyn Downs Family Medical Center in Seattle, which is named for a former member of the Black Panther Party who started the Black Panther Health People's Free Medical Clinic in Seattle, in the Seattle chapter in 1968. And Carolyn Downs would die of cervical cancer in 1970. And this is the Carolyn Downs Clinic in Seattle today is a sliding scale nonprofit. And they explicitly are named for this former member of the Black Panther Party. And if you go in the clinic today, which I did as part of my research, you'll see there's a picture of Carolyn Downs, and they pay tribute to her also with a plaque that basically describes the Black Panthers' work in Seattle in this very same neighborhood doing healthcare. And the clinic leadership declares that they're working in the footprints, following in the footprints of the Black Panther Party. It's also the case that many of the people that I interviewed who had worked in Panther clinics are still involved in health work in various forms in their local communities. So, one woman I interviewed who was a member of the New York Panthers working uptown in Manhattan and Harlem and also in the Bronx now works in a community development health and health outreach for a large hospital in New York City. And people went on to get trained as doctors and nurses and these sorts of things.
Well, Professor Alondra Nelson, tell us a little bit about yourself, your childhood. What occurred in your experience that fomented the development of these ideas in you?
Yes, I grew up in San Diego, California. I was the grandchild, I guess, of migrants from the Great Migration. So my father is from New Orleans, Louisiana, and his parents moved from New Orleans to Los Angeles in around World War II. And on my mother's side, my mother's father was an immigrant from Jamaica, And my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was a migrant from Georgia who came to Washington, D.C., as I mentioned earlier. The migrant part of the Black Panther story, I think, very much resonates with me, and this sort of sense that I think the children and grandchildren of migrants and immigrants have of, you know, wanting life to be better, or working hard for life to make things easier for your parents and also to have life better for yourself. And so I think that that piece of the Black Panther story resonates with me, although I've never been an activist. I think that the migrant part is part of what attracts me to the story for sure.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious and ask a couple of questions. One would be a eureka or an aha moment in your life that you follow that was a shift in your life.
It was the end of a significant romantic relationship, and the gift of that, you know, what at the time was quite sad, a moment in my life was the realization that I think that life is really about change. You know, I think that we get that and we know that and we say that, but the sort of deep realization that part of the beauty of life is about its dynamism and its change, and it's and that the fact that this dynamism and change offers for us, you know, new beginnings, constant surprises, ways to be stronger, new ways of seeing the world.
And tell us, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
It is one precious life, isn't it, Barry? It's so true. What I want to do with the remainder of my life is love those that I love as best as I can and serve those that I love as best as I can, and also to be of service to the world in any way that I can. And as a scholar, for me, that's to, you know, write stories that haven't been written and to hope that these stories can be of service to others.
Are there stories currently in the works that you could share with us, you could tell us about?
Right now I'm working on a book called Reconciliation Projects, which is about the use of genetic ancestry tracing. I work in sort of the sociology of race and ethnicity and what might be called African American studies, and I also work in another area, which is the sociology of science and medicine. And so in this project, I'm interested in the phenomenon of genetic ancestry testing, particularly about amongst African Americans, and how these tests are being used to sort of reconcile in the sort of Truth and Reconciliation Commission way aspects of American history, particularly the after effects of slavery in the U.S.
And finally, Alondra Nelson, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Absolutely. There's so many books I'd recommend to your listeners, but one of the things I wanted to say about in response to your question about the one precious life was also just to experience beauty and to read beauty and take beauty in and just take time to experience all the beauty in the world. And with that in mind, the book that I want to recommend to your readers is Crave Radiance, New and Selected Poems by Elizabeth Alexander, which is filled with nuggets of beauty and wisdom. It's just an awe-inspiring book.
Professor Alondra Nelson, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much, Barry. It was great to be with you.
Alondra Nelson is a professor of sociology and gender studies at Columbia University in New York City. She's the author of Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. The book she recommends is Crave Radiance, New and Selected Poems by Elizabeth Alexander. Professor Nelson's website is Alondra Nelson, AlondraNelson.com. All Radio Curious programs are free at our website, radiocurious.org. Our phone is 707-462-6541. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onestad is our associate producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.